added to the waiting room. You cannot talk or listen until the host admits you to the meeting. You are muted. You can mute or unmute yourself by pressing *6.
But, you know, to CA4 and CA5, if there's not any more on CA2 and 3, I know you asked Elizabeth a lot of questions on barrier busters and the need that we're seeing from folks, funding, et cetera. I'm not sure if anybody wanted to talk about that. There is additional money that's being asked for to help assist folks who find themselves in a very bad position financially. So 8-vote requirements, because they do alter the budget. And so I don't think there will be a no by any council members. I hope not. Perhaps there would be, but I am just concerned with the needs of folks who are increasingly going to programs like this. That's a troubling sign. It's people are going to these programs much more now than before, and we're hopefully we're not doing anything to compound that problem.
The questions I was asking were mostly, I wanted to verify that this program is actually like providing immediate help. Like I was mostly interested in the mechanics of how well we're getting the funds to the people who need it. Kathy and I are part of an organization. We volunteer at the Ann Arbor Thrift Shop, where we have, you know, a direct grant line, which is just, it's really, really good in terms of very, very quickly getting money to people who need it. And so I those were a lot of my questions, and I thought it was interesting that you were asking about how much we're actually covering for utilities, because that's an interesting question. Yeah,
and I was surprised when they said they can, you know, approve help in 2 or 3 days. So it's a pretty quick turnaround, which is impressive, and hopefully gets the right folks. Moving along, I guess, unless we want to talk more about that, but I think we will tomorrow. I think Jeff will probably have some questions, but I know people are going to want to talk perhaps about CA11. We're talking about a lot of things on this agenda, on this consent agenda, that have to deal with folks that are less fortunate, talking about
the host will be informed that you would like to speak.
Talking about the poverty guidelines, and we're talking about warming shelter. So we're in this phase now where we're addressing our social needs. So in that respect, I think is a unique agenda as it addresses some of those problems that are exacerbated now, obviously by COVID-19. But CA13 and CA14 need to they deal with outside legal. Staff being contracted by the city to handle more specialized law. CA13 is part of the huge issue that we have on the horizon with the Han class action lawsuit that's being brought against the city for the water rates, storm water rates, and sewer that are being allegedly claimed as being unfair, and they're seeking financial damages. So this CA13, it would be the First Amendment to the original contract that has been already executed by the city administrator, I believe, with this particular law firm in this matter. Unfortunately, I just have an issue with how things start, I guess, and we're at the beginning of this process. My issue with CA 13 is this is a rather extremely significant issue that this council and most likely sounds like a future council will be dealing with in the same kind of duration and that we have had with I don't really want to compare it to Gelman, but it is going to be a lengthy, expensive lawsuit. And so this first contract was signed for $25,000 without council approval, whatever, and then come back to council now and ask for $180,000. And where does this lead? I ask questions on the agenda as how much work will this get the city? And we were told that they're projecting that this $180,000 would last until the end of this fiscal year, and that most likely there will be another ask in the next fiscal year. So this $180,000 is essentially just for 6 or 7 months worth of legal work. So you're talking, do the math, and if you're saying 5 years worth of, you know, work, then we're, again, linear numbers. But anyhow, I just want to bring it up, and I think that it needs to be brought up and put a light on.
Ali, Michelle Hughes has a question about this item. And while he's...
Are you going to do the controls for me, Kathy?
I can, or can you see the people who are are listed? Oh, pardon me?
Yeah.
Okay, would you like me to do it?
Well, does any other council member have anything to say on this particular item before we go to the public?
Ralph McKee just joined us, as well as Ann Bannister, Tom Stahlberg, but and the other problem is there was a report that people could not get in based on the information on Legistar, but I was just able to get in when the personal ID is requested. You can just hit pound sign again because we don't have one for this meeting. Okay. Michelle, would you like to speak?
You are unmuted. You are muted.
Well, I don't know. I guess I'll respond if that's okay, unless other people want to. But in the case of the Red Roof Inn, you know, that property was sold and going to be redeveloped into a 6-story hotel. So we are losing those rooms that were used early on in the pandemic to house people who are insecure with homes. So I know that much of the work that gets done, the management of the programming and such, is done by the county, and the city mostly just writes a check, for lack of a better word. And I know Councilmember Nelson has asked that we ask the University of Michigan to step up and help with maybe some space that they have that they're not using to address this crisis that we have. But I don't have a whole lot right now on the fly to let you know on that without making a misstatement.
I actually had a conversation with Paul Brown on Friday. Actually, Ian Robinson was on the call as well. He helped arrange it. He's one of the regents of the U of M. And I have been talking to some students also about putting pressure on the U of M to think strategically about what kind of housing might be available. And I'm actually hopeful, cautiously optimistic, that the university might think seriously about making rooms available on North Campus. I probably shouldn't say more details than that, but basically I'm hoping that the students can make enough of a noise or a stink about it that the university realizes that would be a good thing to do. Because the city doesn't have a whole lot of options in terms of just knocking on hotel doors and asking for rooms. And like Ali said, these services are administered at the county level. And the county has asked us a few times to help fund things, and we have approved everything they've asked for. But this is a really big problem, and it's a little bit scary how bad it could potentially get if people are evicted. So.
Yeah, I understand that the federal moratorium is set to expire, but then yet it could be extended for another 30 days with this next round of CARES Act to go until the end of January. So the problem isn't as bad as it will be later. Unfortunately, I think things are being held together by that moratorium at the federal level.
No, Michelle, I will get more information before the meeting tomorrow night, because it's my understanding that a shelter has been established in one of the churches on the west side of Ann Arbor. But I'd rather get the exact information from the county, because they're administering this program. And I can't believe that we've lost 50 beds. They must have been just reassigned, because there would have been a huge public outcry. But I will verify that.
You are unmuted.
Oh, thank you. Next question, Michelle.
Sure. Right.
You
okay,
are
thanks.
Muted.
And again, I will check so that I'm giving accurate information.
I guess we'll go to our next
Ralph has his hand up.
Ralph, if you want to hit star six.
I'm on my Zoom. Can you hear?
Yep.
I guess I just wanted to make a brief comment about the CA-13, and I guess it relates to B-2 also. And I sent a lengthy email earlier today, which you may have seen or may not have seen. And the essence of it is that lawsuit is going to require a very different process, in my view, than what would have been normal if the administrator and legal department hadn't been involved either by action or inaction to get us here. And so I think council, unfortunately, is going to really have to be hands-on directly managing this lawsuit. I think it's appropriate to game plan for the cost. The $180,000 for through the end of June would seem to me to be a fairly normal amount if you're actively litigating it or if you're doing research to potentially settle it. But I think at the outset, before just letting counsel run this case, outside counsel, SEL, you guys and gals will have to really understand this lawsuit to the bone to decide what to do with it. Because this isn't a case where, given the relationships between the city administration and staff and legal department getting us here, essentially, they really should not be managing it in a hands-on way. That needs to be changed from normal process given the circumstances. And this is the worst financial hit that the city has ever faced. It's tens of millions of dollars. The maximum might be $70 million or more. And you can't just let that run like a year or 2 years or something, just fighting it without really knowing what's going to go on. And so I think you need to, push for stopping funding anything that would increase the damages. That includes funding forestry, lawyer fees, increasing rates. Every single thing like that is just going to be tacked onto the lawsuit. Every single thing like that. So that needs to be minimized and stopped. And you really need to sit with outside counsel and push them in great detail and depth about how good are these claims, what are their estimates about the ultimate exposure, and so on. Just like if it was your own business getting sued for $70 million. That's what needs to happen here. That's all I have.
Do we have any other callers who'd like to talk about anything on the consent agenda, including C-8-13? We have Jim and Juliet Kressel, *6.
I guess, can you hear me? I didn't do
yes.
*6. Okay. So I just want to emphasize that as a member of the rank and file, the fact that the water money is being used to fund anything unrelated to water, just because somebody can come up with some sort of clever rationale, is not acceptable. I said this earlier at Elizabeth's coffee hour, it is even beyond that, it is even more unacceptable that somebody thinks that the legal fees should come out of the water fund, because I don't know how many people are going to join this class action suit. But the bottom line is the only people who are qualified to join it are people who are in the Ann Arbor water system. And as more and more people get their bill, the ranks of people are going to swell, very conceivably anyhow, who are eligible to be part of this class action suit. And it does not seem appropriate that they should be paying the city's legal fees out of the water fund, that the water bills that they are objecting to paying. It really needs to come out of some other part of the budget having to do with wherever you normally get your legal fees paid from, which I assume would be the general fund, although I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's a risk.
There's a real slap in the face to have to find out that, oh, well, because the city did this boneheaded thing to begin with, and now they're facing this class action suit, that some 200, 205, 200, whatever, I can't do the math right now, but some $200,000 is going to be expected to come out of the increased water fund that we are objecting to.
Right, and we've already raised the water rate, so it's really like more like a poke in the eye. And surely if there is a resolve of this that's not favorable to the city, I would suspect that that'll be noted. in the future, as a previous caller kind of indicated. So,
and that may seem a little fastidious because, you know, we're still paying for the city's budget, but it's appropriate for it to come out of wherever the legal fund normally comes out of. It shouldn't come out of the water. That's nuts.
Well, we appreciate those comments. We'll go to our next caller if you're all set with that agenda item. Tom Stahlberg.
Good evening, everybody. I was alerted to this by an attorney that's in Oakland County a long time ago. This is a really serious issue, and we have a really, I can't say whether we're going to win or lose this case, but it's a real case. There's absolutely nothing frivolous about this. The law firm's got a track record with this type of lawsuit, and they've done well. So the last thing we should be doing is just trying to be puff up our chests and say, well, we'll keep doing what we're doing. We'll keep charging things through our water fund as if we're not doing anything wrong. Let's make some defensive speeches and let's say, you know, double down on our position. That is the last thing we should be doing here. Nothing should be coming out of the fund except service at this point in time. We have to be extra careful, and I'm really afraid is not the right word. I'm really concerned about some of the speeches that were made at some of the other items that were voted on by council and some of the things that have been said. I just urge you to be super cautious about running these legal fees through the water and sewer fund. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. We're just joined by Glenn Nelson. I'm not sure if Glenn wanted to speak to anything on the consent agenda. You did send us an email.
Yes, I would like to speak briefly on item 11, the poverty exemption. Is now an appropriate time?
Absolutely.
The low-income households in Ann Arbor are being hit very hard currently, and it's a combination of unemployment, loss of income due to COVID, and because of our high property taxes and increasing property taxes in Ann Arbor. For example, and I favored these things, we passed the school bond and we passed the affordable housing, which are new millages. Many of them are having a great deal of trouble paying their mortgage and their taxes. The response of some is to leave Ann Arbor because of the high cost. What's happening to others is that they're facing foreclosure, either because of mortgage foreclosure or tax foreclosure. This is obviously a very bad outcome. It's bad in terms of equity. Low-income people should not have to bear the burden of COVID-19, and especially in the context of when many professional people are relatively unscathed. And it's also bad for our diversity, an important dimension of diversity is economic diversity. And the what's happening is we're driving out lower income households from the city of Ann Arbor. There's an urgent need to strengthen our property tax relief programs. A major way to do that is the poverty exemption program. What that does is for households who qualify, they are then exempt from paying property taxes. I think we in Ann Arbor should be a leader in this program with respect to making it possible for low-income households to participate. But in fact, we're something of a laggard in the county. And I don't mean to use a shame tactic here. I just want to say that places like Saline, Dexter, Chelsea, Pittsfield Township are more understanding of the need for relief from property taxes for low-income households than Ann Arbor. So I would like to see you pull item 11 from the consent agenda, talk about it as to what is the situation for low-income households, talk about what the situation should be. And I would like the result of that to be that you would stipulate to the Board of Review, or really to the assessor, to use 2.2 times the federal poverty standard as the threshold of eligibility, and that that would be much better than it is now. And if you don't see your way to go all the way to 2.2, but stop at something like 2, then I understand the need for compromise in these systems. So that's my, that's what I'm very concerned about.
I want to say something, because I want to thank Glenn for sending us that email, and it was rather shocking to me to see the comparisons that you listed for us with between the neighboring communities. It does seem upside down and backwards that we are not leading on this issue. It seems upside down and backwards that we have a poverty exemption that is lower than communities that I would have guessed are less expensive to live in. Very odd.
Yeah. And have a reputation for being less progressive, less liberal than Ann Arbor. Not to pick on anyone specifically, but I find it shocking that the Saline City Council is more sympathetic or empathetic for low-income households than the Ann Arbor City Council has been in the past. And of course, you're facing the received policy of previous councils. I know this isn't your doing.
I have a question. And this goes back to my time on the school board and Head Start. Could one of the arguments, and I'm not holding this position, but could one of the reasons that it is lower in Ann Arbor is because of the perceived view that we have temporary poverty connected with the University of Michigan with graduate students?
It could be, but I don't think most of them are homeowners. And this is a property tax exemption,
right?
So that might come into the perception, but I don't think we're getting many residential property taxes from graduate students.
Okay. I would agree with you. I just know that excuse is frequently given. So it would probably be good to look into that further, and I can do that. Yeah. Okay, thanks.
Well, thanks for all the great points that have been brought up. I could stay on this topic or in these topics for the rest of the time, but I know we got to get through everything else.
Sure.
And I'm sure they'll be interwoven. We do appreciate the emails that you sent in, and supporting the idea that you bring forward. Very helpful for folks that like us to do what you wished for us to do. So it takes a village.
And I could just add one note of thanks that for whatever reason, my heir or the heir on the agenda, I could not get in with the phone numbers that are printed on the agenda. And I have Kathy's phone number in my phone, so I sent her a message and she quickly sent me the link to the Zoom. So a big thank you to Kathy. And I know it really reflects all of you in the caucus, you know, inviting people and helping us to come in. So thank you to all of you for that kind of
thing. Oh, effort. You're welcome. We seem to have a problem with Zoom. I was able to call and get right in. So I think it's a technical problem with Zoom not being consistent. You're not the only one tonight.
Okay. Anyway, big thank you.
You're welcome.
So I guess we'll move on so we can stay on track. CA 15 is a resolution to approve the collective bargaining agreement between the City of Ann Arbor and the Police Services Specialists beginning in January. There's, I think, 10 people in that union. I think 10 or 12 people in that union. Seems that certain gains were made, and I think that there's a freeze on the first year rate wage increase. So anyhow, more questions can be asked tomorrow about that, but that's a pretty important contract that's also on the consent agenda. Public hearings, I guess, we'll cover when we talk about them later in the agenda. We have second readings on ordinances B1, an ordinance to amend section 5.16.6 and 5.18.4 of chapter 55 of the UDC of Title 5 of the Code of City of Ann Arbor, dealing with the exceptions to height limits of solar panels. I think we're all in agreement based on our first reading that there's nothing here that has drawn any criticism or concerns by and large. So I'm not sure if anybody here wants to talk on that, but now's your chance before the big one comes next. I guess when we move to B2, B2 is the ordinance to amend section 2.63 of chapter 29, the water rates of the City of Ann Arbor. This is the second reading of this somewhat contentious issue that we have. And I say that because of just the issues that surround it as we talk about increasing water rates during a pandemic, increasing water rates in light of a class action lawsuit, and increasing water rates at the twice of the rate of inflation, increasing water rates for years and years and years. This is not just a one-time increase or the fact that we haven't increased them in 5 years. This is one of nearly a dozen increases in that many years. So we're still in the middle of it. This one strikes me as a little odd, and I'll get to that a little later. But I'll let my colleagues and weigh in on it if they have anything to weigh in on. This one strikes me as odd because generally we ask for 1 year rate increases at a time. This resolution is asking for two rate increases in one vote. That to me is quite odd. I have actually asked staff to prepare an amendment to this resolution, and that amendment simply would decouple 2 years in this resolution and force the second rate increase that would go into effect in July to be voted on later, as in normal times when we adopt our budget. The fact that the following fiscal year is being rolled into this one seems a little premature on that vote for that period. So expect that amendment tomorrow. And I think it's embedded in this one, but it's not very clear. But there will be hopefully a vote on that to just delay that July increase to a later date on the vote, and then have the one that was postponed from earlier this year to go into effect on January 1st. I guess from that, I'll just talk about a little bit about the concerns that we're hearing regarding the money used for CA-13 and the respects that it has with B-2 in this. And I guess I can wait till later. We've been cautioned to tread lightly when talking about this topic. We'll have to learn more as CMs what that necessarily means, what we can talk about, what we can't talk about. But we've been advised that statements made may be held against the city if we speak too freely when it comes to certain issues like this. So just know that we are operating with that halo around us. Kathy?
While we are restricted in what we can say at this point, we're definitely not restricted in what we can read, and I appreciate all the information that's coming from constituents.
Well, I would suspect that B2 most likely will be approved tomorrow based on the conversations that were had at the first reading. I don't think that new council members, and with all due respect, are comfortable enough to go against strong staff recommendations on these rate increases. Staff has, and the city has realized we are receiving far fewer dollars than they were projected, and because of the University of Michigan and other users reducing their consumption. We have a $1.4 million shortfall in what we're projected to receive, infrastructure improvements are falling behind. So there is going to be a very strong argument tomorrow to go forward with this proposed plan. Anybody in the public want to speak on this? Ralph, your hand is raised.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on a couple pieces briefly there. I think the issue of what you're allowed to talk about and so on should be addressed at your absolute first opportunity with outside counsel, not with the legal department that was involved in getting us into this lawsuit to begin with. I understand what the concern is. I mean, in the second amended complaint, there's a quotation of a statement that Jack Eaton made at a council meeting, and I understand why council might be concerned about that. But I think what a council person says about the merits or lack thereof of a particular thing, you can't be completely muzzled about right. Talking about this in public when the issue is really, if you increase your reserves, which is what a rate increase does, that has an impact on this lawsuit. And that needs to be discussed in closed session first, that's fine. I appreciate that. But those discussions need to be had, and they need to be blunt, because otherwise you're just being muzzled for potentially sort of hiding the ball from the public is too strong, probably, but that's sort of what it looks like from the outside. And as to the merits, that's the central part of this lawsuit, is that the increases are overcharges. That's the essence of this lawsuit, the guts of it. $37 million plus is that piece. And so those discussions with outside counsel need to be had sooner rather than later, because every increase is going to be in the next amendment to that complaint, period. That is 100% for sure. From my perspective, I you know, you get to a trial and they're just going to tack every single increase on. There's zero question about that. And these lawyers are good lawyers. I know who they are. I know some of them. They're going to be very thorough about that. So again, I encourage the discussions with outside counsel sooner rather than later. Thank you.
Thanks. I appreciate that, because we had similar discussions regarding the EPA, and I think that has been resolved, but I feel like the process is the same, and it's very uncomfortable.
Well, yeah, I appreciate the advice that we're getting. I'm just a little disappointed with not being involved with this decision earlier and with more detail. Questions that were asked were and advice that's been given has been very vague, and too vague for persons in our position. I agree with Ralph and what he says. This is a policy issue that needs to be steered by counsel, by the elected officials, by the policymakers, more than many other issues, and not one that should be deferred to staff as much as perhaps that group would like that power to reside with them. I just have been very disappointed with the lack of information that we've been given on this issue, and the process it's taken to this point. That first $25,000 contract is signed. That can essentially, plant a seed in the trajectory of this whole thing, and we need to know what direction it's going in before it's too far down the path. But that's where I'm at. It's just there has not been enough information given to the elected officials. And I guess it's up for us to demand it and to ask for it. Anyone else? All right. I guess that moves us on to C1. Brought forward by the Planning Commission, an ordinance to amend sections 5.16. I won't read all the numbers and letters. I will if you really need me to, but this governs the UDC, marijuana processor, ADU, security, building materials, FAR determinations, fence graphic, use tables. Going through this, it just seemed most of this was just cleaning errors that were in existence from other periods of time when things were changed, but also some other material differences that have more substantial consequences. So this is first reading, opportunity to look this over, get feedback from our community to if there are concerns with anything that is being proposed with this. but this is being again brought forward by staff. Any input? I guess we go to C2, an amendment to add a new section to 5.19, 5.191, 5.91 section, so on and so forth. It essentially gets to electric vehicle parking and the charging stations. Anybody want to speak on C2?
Hi, this is Rita. I would like to say a couple of things. And that is that I do appreciate and support electrification as part of the H20 program and moving toward more clean energy for future. My concern with this one has to do with the whole aspect of the energy that will be produced is actually going to result in us exporting our carbon to our neighbors in Detroit, because the electricity is going to be produced not by renewable energy, by solar panels or any other type of renewable energy, but by electricity from DTE. And I bet DTE is just totally happy to have high-powered electric chargers placed in Ann Arbor that they'll be able to charge for. So that's cool for them, but really, I would suggest that you ask how much energy is going to be required and where the emissions will take place. I think that's a key question in terms of us getting to an earth of cooler temperature. And I know this is just a small part of it, but that's my opinion of these kinds of installations. I think the idea is great. I like electric vehicles. That's great. But the my point is that we're essentially exporting our emissions.
Thank you, Rita. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think about that now every time I turn on a light switch.
me too.
You planted that thought in my head, and it definitely reminds me to be more conscientious. But, it does require, new buildings to have, electric charging stations that perhaps may be around for a lot longer than some of these coal fired power plants that produce the electricity. So I guess it's we're looking through very optimistic lenses here in the hopes that solar generation will come on far quicker than DT would like. And but your concern is a valid for sure. It is the economic, social injustices that climate change bring on to everybody are exasperated based on your zip code. So appreciate you. Anyone else want to talk about C2 before we move to C3, which may have more interest with the general broader community? And C3, an ordinance to amend Chapter 55 zoning. It's the rezoning of 7.23 acres from RC1, single family residential district, to a PUD, planned unit development district. This is for Lockwood of Ann Arbor, PUD zoning and supplemental regulations, 2195 East Ellsworth. The Planning Commission has given us a 7-0 recommendation for this site and development. This was, pretty much the same. It's obviously the same ownership that came to council 2 years ago to have this built over the highest concentrations of dioxin in our city, and it had some issues besides that as well that didn't get the support of council in the end. And so the petitioner has found a new part of the city to develop these units for senior living. And it's back before council for consideration, first reading. Anybody would like to talk about this? This is, I think, 154 units, and 65 of them are for affordable housing for 99 years. It is 50% of AMI. So that does offer the public benefit that must be a part of a PUD. And there are some other improvements, contributions made to our park fund, sidewalk installation of 500 feet, and some other public benefits. The one issue that constituents have raised, outside of course, with every development of traffic being always a common given for every part, but this one, aside from that, is with the storm runoff and the location of the property relative to its neighbors and the high point of this parcel and the runoff, central runoff that could exacerbate existing issues and problems. But that, unfortunately, has been one of the concerns that I've received a few emails about. But this resides in Ward 3, and we don't, unfortunately, have anyone from Ward 3 right now to maybe help understand more of the issues surrounding this.
I had a conversation with Travis yesterday, because I wanted to hear his take. I have not had many conversations with Ward 3 residents about this development, but I did have a conversation recently. I've not had many conversations, but a couple of months ago, I had a chat with Susan Basquette, and she had some concerns about it. Travis explained to me that the first version of this development did have issues that he understood and shared with the nearby residents, but for him, a lot of them have been addressed, and he feels like they did fix some problems. Like this is secondhand from Travis, and I might not be remembering it exactly accurately, but Travis was saying that there was one version of this project that would have had a parking lot like 15 feet from the property line with Forest Brook, and some of the housing units at Forest Brook are actually pretty close to the property line. So you would have a situation of cars in the parking lot, you know, with like headlights pointing in the direction of windows at 15 feet away. And that was understandably something that they would be not excited about. And I guess the project was adapted or was shifted around so that now instead of a 15-foot buffer with this parking lot, it's like 70 feet. And they're going to be growing trees and creating other barriers. So that is much less concerning. I mean, I have a parking lot probably 70 feet from my backyard because I back up to a church. 70 feet's a pretty good buffer. I don't see headlights. I feel like this is something that does not have nearly the challenges that were connected to it when it was in Ward 5. So I'll be curious to hear the conversation at the table tomorrow night.
So that's Forest Hills Cooperative, not
Forest Hills. That's right. Not Forest Brook. Sorry. Forest Hills.
Forest Hills Cooperative. Yeah. So yeah. And we have Tom Stolberg first.
Yes. I'm not going to argue for or against this development. But I think people on social media expect me to speak about PUDs, so I will. We seem very hypocritical about PUDs, or inconsistent, maybe would be a better word. When we want to get around zoning, PUDs seem to be fine. When there's something we want, and all of a sudden, you know, when people want something different, then they say PUDs aren't viable, or they're too hard or too complicated. You know, PUDs are just an option in our zoning. It provides a trade-off And it's a good tool to use when you have something that doesn't fit standard zoning. So PUDs are inherently neither good nor bad. They just are. But it really does strike me that certain people make speeches about how problematic PUDs are when they want to get around something, and then they are going to vote or speak in favor of PUDs when it serves their desires. So I'm just pointing out inconsistencies. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. And then we have a caller with the number ending in 618. If you'd like to hit star six.
Hi, this is also Michelle. My other phone wasn't working for some reason. I just wanted to call and say that I think we missed an opportunity last time with the Lockwood development. And since we sorely need affordable housing in the city, we need to be looking for excuses to say yes here instead of looking for excuses to say no. So we need affordable housing. We need to treat this like a crisis. And if we've got an opportunity here, let's take it. And this looks like a real good opportunity to me. We're talking about them going way above and beyond in terms of providing affordable housing, way above and beyond what is required of them, and talking about affordable senior living. And I think that's something that we desperately need in this town. So I say find a way to say yes about this. That's all. Thanks.
Thank you, Michelle. Anyone else like to talk about the rezoning of 2195 East Ellsworth? Well, I'll just say that, yeah, I agree. PUDs are like anything else. They're a tool. They could be, you know, used properly, or they could be used improperly. And I think, you know, in this case, that I don't see any reason not to support this. I thought that the comments and questions that have been raised about this have were proper. And you know, Michelle just raising the fact that, yeah, we're still in a crisis, even though we've passed the affordable housing millage and some other issues that we've worked on. We know that it's going to take more than just a couple things to alleviate the crisis. So we'll look forward to hearing more from Waterbury residents about this particular project as it comes back to council for second reading, ultimately at the beginning of the new year. C4 is an amendment to an ordinance to amend Chapter 55 of the UDC, zoning of 0.9 acres from parking to C3 fringe commercial. This is at 2111 Packard Street. Again, this has got the recommendation from Planning Commission 7-0. This is part of a larger development on Packard, across the street from Morgan and York. I think it houses currently B Green, that development over there with Marcos Pizza and such, been there for a long time. Do we have anybody on council who would like to talk about this particular item? Yeah.
I'll be supporting this, and I believe it was an excellent community engagement process, so I would like to acknowledge that. At the same time, I think we have to be careful of using labels such as healthy streets or affordable housing without understanding the details behind it, because frequently there are problems. And I believe, and so did the majority of council, that there were major problems with Lockwood 1, especially the Gelman plume, the 1,4-dioxane contamination that was under that property. And so I hesitate to let comments go that are rewriting history without a comment.
Thank you, Kathy. So with C4, this is, again, part of a bigger redevelopment project that did involve community engagement. I know the petitioner reached out to myself way back before COVID began to better understand what council would like to see, what we want. Let me know that this was going to be going on. My concern was for the small businesses that are currently there. How do we, you know, it is an area of town that allowed for small businesses to rent at somewhat affordable rates. Those folks are going to be, relocated, hopefully, in the process here and done in a sensitive way. But we do have 118 bedrooms. It's located on a transit line. It has a lot of the issues to achieve our, a lot of the traits to achieve our goals with carbon neutrality. And I really am excited about this project. I'm sure there's probably some things I don't know that are going to dampen that excitement, but I really feel like this is a very positive redevelopment. And that part of town could really use it, and this could be putting people in areas of our town who can walk to store and to the park and to their friends. It's a very walkable and convenient part of town to live in to get what you need. We have 618 back on the line.
Oh, hi, this is Michelle again. You said you were talking about relocating businesses. I didn't see it. I was confused because I thought this ordinance was just rezoning a thing that was just a parking lot. But is it part of a larger plan where we're going to get a site plan later on that's going to knock down an existing building?
This is a redevelopment.
I believe so. Yeah, this is only one of many motions I believe that council will need to weigh in. This is just a part of it.
There's going to be housing there. I mean, like Kathy said, the developer worked really closely with the neighborhood, and it seems like it was a pretty good collaborative process. There's going to be a three-story building with, I think it's three stories, with apartments. And so that part of the parcel needed to be rezoned so that they could develop the whole of it as a single site with the same zoning. And I can't remember the details of how they're going to do parking, because of course they have to do parking. But that's the reason.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, I just didn't understand that this was part of a larger thing. Okay, cool. Thanks.
Cool. So then we get into new business, which gets, interesting. DC1, a resolution to direct amendments to city code to prospectively apply locational restrictions to short-term rentals. Good thing we got an attorney on the line here, or we got two of them. We got to forget. That can help explain what those fancy words mean in this title.
I think we've actually gotten a couple of emails from residents about this, including yours, Ralph. I have to say that I have not fully read yours closely, but basically this is revisiting. I'm a little bit frustrated by DC1 because it's revisiting discussions that we kind of already had. This is a suggestion. It doesn't have the word in it, but it's basically the idea of grandfathering. It's the idea of it's asking staff to look at amendments to the ordinance that would preserve the businesses that are already in place. And so our original ordinance that we passed in September, staff recommended to us that really the best way to regulate short-term rentals was to understand it as a zoning issue. that this was an activity that was commercial in nature, and we should limit it to short-term rentals that were non-owner occupied. That is to say, it's a house that you own. You do not live in that house. It is not your residence. You're effectively turning it into a commercial business when you turn it into a full-time STR. Staff told us that this was a zoning issue, that really that activity, it doesn't create a resident, and therefore it shouldn't be in residential neighborhoods. It really should only be permitted in areas of the city that are zoned for mixed use or commercial. And so having made that choice, the ordinance that we passed restricted non-owner occupied STRs to a pretty limited area of the city, and required licensing and registration for people who are doing short-term rental out of the homes that they live in. So in Ward 4, we got a couple of streets that people are really happy to get that extra income, vacate their home for a few weekends a year, and it covers their property taxes or some aspect of our high cost of living here. That will be permitted. It's people who are using their residence and having an extra use for it, the same as if you're teaching piano lessons out of your living room. We're treating it kind of like that. At any rate, so this resolution is asking staff to suggest how can we craft an amendment to the ordinance to say we're not going to rezone, or we're not going to apply our zoning as the original ordinance and suggested. We're going to look at it moving forward. We're going to figure out a way to craft exceptions for people who have already established non-owner occupied STRs in areas of the city that are zoned residential. I don't think it's a good thing to do. I'm not planning to support this. The sky isn't falling, because really it is just, this is the first discussion of what would have to be, there would have to be another discussion about what those amendments would look like. So if this passes, there will still be yet another discussion about whether or not we do want to grandfather these STR businesses. But the last time we discussed this, we talked about how this was going to be giving a pretty huge advantage to people who are already existing. It was going to create effectively a monopoly for everybody who had already established a short-term rental in a residential neighborhood. This is an issue that impacts Ward 4. I don't know how much it impacts other wards. It probably impacts Ward 5 a good bit. But we have a lot of residential streets that are within striking distance of the stadium. And those are properties that have been appealing as in investments for short-term rental. And it changes the nature of a neighborhood. So I'll stop talking now and I'll let somebody else talk.
Thanks, council member. To me, it is a regressive form of policy. I simply don't understand the rationale behind this. If our stated goals and policies are as such, to do as much as we possibly can to address affordable housing. We just recently asked the citizens to pay one and then an additional mill to provide affordable housing. We should be doing as much as we can outside of that as well. It's been stated even with that millage, we still won't meet our goals. And aside from that, the idea of grandfathering in properties that have been told to us that are nearly impossible to identify. They don't even know how many properties exist. I had asked some questions regarding this issue to staff, and the response that we got back from staff is that there is approximately, in their estimate, 1,400 units that are being operated in the city limits, mostly in single family zoning. So that's almost 1,000 units of housing that are not being used to house people who live and work here. And I'm all about being inviting and welcoming people into our community, especially considering what I do for a living. But I also understand that we need to be consistent, and frankly, this is very inconsistent if we're trying to tackle affordable housing by taking out over a thousand homes and turning them into investments. I mean, Airbnb just went public. Tell me that these aren't commercial enterprises inside areas of the city that are designated for things that are not commercial. It's hard for me to support. So I'll leave it at that, and that Tom had his hand up first.
Thanks. I am not an attorney, but I want to throw out some legal questions for you to ask whomever you deem appropriate to ask. So in the zoning world that I'm familiar with, unequal treatment in zoning law is a pretty big no-no. That's a nice legal word for you. What we're setting ourselves up for here is an invitation for future challenges to our law, and specifically a challenge that would overturn the ordinance that we've already passed. Somebody in the future could challenge this and say, I want to have a non-owner occupied Airbnb in a residential zoned area, and that other guy over there does, and that person does, and the person across the street from where I want it does. And you're basing this law on zoning arguments, and we're zoned the same, and you've got to treat me equal. The ramification of that could be overturning the ordinance that we've already passed. A much better way to handle this is to just leave the law alone like you have it. There has been a potential threat of legal action by some of the people who are in this situation. If they choose to sue, you know, that's up to them. And what would happen as a result of that is to be determined. One of the possibilities that could happen would be that the city settles with the people who currently have it to find some way to create whatever creative thing that comes up. It could be a transition period that's extended, but it wouldn't threaten the law itself, because that settlement would be very specific in terms of what deal is made between those people who may find themselves in it. They're already operating something now. They've got some kind of investment. And if you want to have some sympathy towards that, that might be the place to work with them. But to do something that changes the law that we've already passed, I think risks the entire new law being overturned sometime in the future. Thank you.
Thanks, Tom. The next person is Jim and Juliet.
Hi there. So I had kind of lost the thread of this, and as the other lawyer on the on the calls, no, I'm not going to unravel the language. What I am uncomfortable about, aside from whatever the merits are, is that part of the reason that the conversation on this stalled is because the person to whom it was assigned to issue legal advice from the legal department, last I knew, hadn't really met the deadline that people needed in order to know what solid ground there was for us to do anything, not only the existing ordinance, but the issue of grandfathering. Because my understanding, and I have not looked at that Supreme Court case that was decided relatively recently, my understanding, though, is that grandfathering may be necessary if you're going to avoid a problem, and that basing it on zoning will be a problem. And I don't personally care, because I don't really swim much in those waters, but I want to be absolutely certain that while the city is being sued on this water issue, it isn't carding another lawsuit on how well we are walking the fine lines that have been drawn on this issue, some of them relatively recently, that you've gotten adequate legal advice. And the last I knew, that hadn't really happened, at least not to the comfort level of the council members to whom I was speaking. So I, as a private citizen, want to know that you've gotten the best that the city's legal department can offer, however good that may be.
Thank you. Ralph?
Hi again. I think it's necessary to really think about what the legal framework is here, which hasn't really been identified in a concrete way in this discussion anyway. The legal framework is that the prior uses have the people who have the STRs operating now, they have an argument that they have a prior, what's called a prior non-conforming use. And if they qualify, and that depends on whether they are legal under the current ordinance. So if they have a good argument that the prior ordinance allowed them, then they have a legal use, and you don't have to grandfather them in. They are grandfathered under the law, and a court might have to determine whether they're right or they're wrong. In typical practice in this arena, which I don't swim in these waters either, to use the phrase it was just used, but I have read a lot of these cases, and it's typical in many of the cases for the city or the township to sue the people who they think aren't obeying the new ordinance. And that's what I suggest should be done here, that you take one of them, you pick one out that's clearly a good one, that's been operating before you passed your new ordinance, and you sue them in a quasi-friendly way. And you say, okay, if the court views this as a proper legal non-conforming use under the old ordinance, you don't have to, at that point, you grandfather all of them. You don't fight anymore. You're just, because they're entitled to do that, period, whether you want them to or not. You cannot ban them. But if they're wrong, then you, or what I would like to see happen is that you do that kind of lawsuit and you have a settlement and you settle their claims in some way. They transition out of that. They pay an extra fee. There's a whole there. I can think of a zillion ways to settle that lawsuit rather than I haven't really thought through Tom's points about whether it would create some sort of equal protection argument. I'd have to do a lot more thinking about that. As to what the city attorney's office has done so far, I know for sure they were very late with the advice because I remember they didn't have it together at the first meeting. I have been told that there have been substantive advice provided since then. Obviously, I don't know what that advice was because it's privileged. But my guess is that there's some murk there. And therefore, it would make sense for that murk to be cleared up either by a court ruling or a settlement. And it'd be very simple to do here. You just don't enforce the ordinance until the first test case. You sue somebody as a test, and you just don't enforce it on anybody else until you get a ruling, and or you sit everybody down. The thing that really bothers me about this more than anything else is that I don't think that it would be, and maybe I just don't understand it, but I can't see why you couldn't figure out how many of these are. If somebody just went through the Airbnb and all the other vendors by staff on a daily basis, look at the ads, call them up. I understand that it's being very protective, but the concerns that I have are not the 100 or so mom and pops that every time we have a meeting about this, the small owners all come in and they say, oh, there's just a few of us. There's less than 100. And yet Jane Lum told me at one point that she'd gotten a letter from some of the major corporate realtors in town that had dozens of these. And would it be really hard to just ask them? Get every realtor in town, call them up, say, do you have any STRs? Are they going to lie? I don't, if there are hundreds of these, then this is a major affordable housing issue. And I am really astonished that the affordable housing advocates in this town who have spoken on at virtually every other issue about affordable housing coming out of developments or we need to build more, we need a millage, we need, if it's hundreds of houses and you stay silent, I'm not going to listen to you ever again, because that's just a completely hypocritical stance. If you don't speak up on this to find out if there are hundreds or at least dozens of other units, how many units are we going to get out of that millage every year? I don't know the answer to that. It's a rhetorical question, but I'm betting it's a heck of a lot less than these, and we're paying for that. So why shouldn't, you know, this is a big issue. If there are lots, if there aren't, if the corporate realtors in town don't really own hardly any of these, that's a very small issue, 100, maybe 100, and should be dealt with in a completely different way. But I think the legal framework has to be thought about, and it might have to be thought about in a little bit more out of the box than it has been thus far. I'm not privy to the legal advice that's been given so far. Anyway, I hope that helps.
I appreciate your comments, Ralph. I just want to say that I, early on in these discussions, because this has been talked about for a long time,
yeah,
the ball got rolling with just a resolution, like, let's talk about this, and asking staff to come up with an idea about it. Early on, I had a meeting with people who were managing STRs in town. And in that conversation, they told me that I shouldn't be wanting to push this issue because it was a really positive stimulus to the economy. And by their estimates, there were over 200 full-time Airbnb, just like non-owner occupied, just for rent on a short-term basis. And I reconstruct that conversation, and I cannot think of why they would have either underreported or overreported that number. Like, they didn't really have any reason to tell me a number that was wildly off base. And they were in the business. And so I have been thinking about this issue, whether or not the consultants were willing to pin down a number or claim to be able to know the number. I've been thinking to myself, it's at least 200, or it's around 200, because that's the number that I was told by people who were really deep into this locally. And that's not insignificant. I mean, I can't remember the last development that we had on our agenda that like 200 units were at stake and didn't cause like a big fuss about like, we need these housing units. Like you say, the fact that it's been a lot of silence from people who have been really loud about other things, it's interesting. I'll say that.
I have one follow comment about that, which relates to what you just said. I'd be tempted to ask them again before making any decisions on this. Okay, you say that you make this statement that there's just this many. Well, I heard something different a long time ago. And how about you tell us? You know, the competitors in this business, they know where every single one of these is. They know that. Make them provide it. Not grandfathering. We're not even thinking about grandfathering you until you tell us where every one of these is. Very simple and blunt.
I'll be real brief on this. I want to get some insight as somebody who does own a short-term rental, a couple of them in another town. And we do rent out to corporate clients. And some of that's not on the market. It's not on Airbnb. So if you're looking at one of our major realtors here in town, they may be managing corporate housing in single family houses for other, you know, individual owners. And it is not on Airbnb or VRBO. That exists. So you're not going to be able to count those or find those easily, but it's going on.
Why not ask them directly?
Right. So that's what I'm saying. Like, it's not going to show up if you just look on Airbnb and VRBO.
Okay.
You got to investigate that a little bit more.
Let's do some detective work.
Well, that's why we're here tonight. We appreciate all the help trying to figure this out. But I do agree that, you know, the current situation isn't perfect. In fact, I asked for an amendment I had brought to the floor on that night to give these owners, you know, more time to get their house in order if they did have to transition out of these properties. And that's why we pushed the date to the end of February or March 1st for this to go into effect. And I am troubled as well as some others have said that the folks who are there to hammer us on redevelopment that may or may not truly bring affordable housing to our community. Here we got a situation where we're giving things away. We're inviting a problem. We're muddling the situation. Like, why don't we wait? Why don't we allow the courts and the property owners to handle this? Why this approach is just, to me, I think, a step in the wrong direction. Rita Mitchell?
Okay, I'll just be quick. I attended one of the public sessions that were held, is it 2 years ago now? I recall that there were two individuals who had a combined listing of something like 15 or 17 houses that they were managing in this way, just as one little tiny, tiny sample of what was going on at that time. And, you know, there were also people who said, this is really lucrative and it is their sole business right now, whatever stage of life they were in. People were, and these were people talking about having at least one non-owner occupied house that is like, it's really lucrative. And I'm not saying people shouldn't make money, but I do feel like the attention to availability of housing for people is something that should be paid. So I appreciate this discussion on it. Thanks.
Thank you, Rita. I guess we need to move on to stay on track, at least hope we do. DC2 is the resolution to adopt city council rules following the 2020 general elections. This is a standard process to adopt these rules. I do not believe there's any changes in any of the rules. That there has been discussion about changing the rules. I'm sure folks have been reading some of the articles in MLive and on social media about improving the relationship among colleagues on council and throughout the community, how we conduct ourselves and conduct the business of the city. We have a subcommittee from the admin committee. I am on the admin committee with Councilmember Griswold, Councilmember Iyer, Mayor Taylor, and Councilmember Grand. The five of us are the new members of the admin committee that recently met, discussed how we can impose rules to facilitate a better board meeting and still have proper public participation and not censor people. So the agreement from our last meeting was that Councilmember Griswold and Councilmember Iyer will go out and work on some recommendations and come back to the admin committee for consideration before it gets sent to council for the body to either adopt or reject or do whatever it pleases with that. But this is just a standard procedural issue right here per city charter. Any questions on this? Kathy?
Yeah, I just want to say that Jen and I have had one meeting, and then there was general agreement on most of the I would say minor changes. There are two other bigger issues. One is we have council rules right now that prohibit personal attacks that we're not enforcing. And I believe that the issues with civility are probably a symptom of an underlying problem. And Ryan Stanton from MLive tweeted an article from 7 years ago where I would say the comments and quotes in that article were worse than what I've experienced during my 2 years on council. So I would appreciate any advice or comments that other people would like to give me, because I think if we're not enforcing our existing rules, modifying our existing rules is not going to be successful. So that's all I have to say. And please help.
Thanks, Kathy, for taking that on and giving us an update. Ralph, is that an old hand? Yes. Okay. New hand, Ralph.
Yeah, I did want to say something about that briefly. I know at the last council meeting where that issue was broached, there was the issue of speakers from outside the city calling and saying things which I think objectively would be viewed as uncivil in a really objective way. And I've probably been uncivil, but I live here. The question that I have, really, I remember, and I might have misheard this, but I thought I heard Mayor Taylor say that you couldn't even ask the identity or the address of legally of people that were speaking at public comment.
Allowed under the Open Meetings Act to ask that they identify themselves, but the Open Meetings Act does not require an address.
Has there been given a legal opinion that says you can't restrict public comment to people who live in the town of the meeting that you're having? That's the question I have.
Yeah, there hasn't. And one of the issues with the Open Meetings Act is it really doesn't take into account technology. I mean, most of it was written many, many years ago. So
in the old version, does it, you know, before Zoom, and I assume before people could still call in long distance, but if you had to appear at the meeting, you'd still have the issue of somebody driving in from Ipsy or Belleville or Chelsea. And my question is, what was the rule about that?
There was no restriction.
Is there a legal basis that you cannot make such a restriction?
I don't know. It's just not addressed. I can remember 15, 20 years ago, people from Flint drove down to an Ann Arbor school board meeting and spoke.
I'm just curious whether I would like to ask, you know, if one of you could ask the legal department for a simple, can you restrict that or you can't? I'm not suggesting you should necessarily, but I heard what I thought Mayor Taylor said is that can't be done.
I heard something similar, but I think what he was actually saying was that we simply didn't have the rule. So what you're suggesting is exactly what we need to ask. Like, fine, we don't have such a rule, but could we have such a rule?
Yes.
Well, I appreciate that, and I took offense to it, because it got to the point where it was where I felt uncivil, and I will probably be attacked next. But that's fine. You know, I'll take it. Just hopefully it's based in truth. And if it is, then bring it on. The issues that I have of folks in California calling to tell us to think about things in Michigan is that there's so many things here at the city level that we can't do because of state statute. Like, back to Airbnbs. It'd be nice to be able to say, I'm going to grandfather these in. If we can tax them, take the money and put it into affordable housing fund, I'd be all about it. But we can't. And there's so many things that we can't do that they can do in other states. So it just really isn't, you know, comparing apples to apples when you form policy. Like, forming policy in Michigan is different than New York, than Delaware, than Florida, than California, etc. So to have folks calling from different states telling us how to form policy here in Michigan doesn't make sense. We have two people. Start with Rita.
Hi. My quick comment is just that recently, with the Gelman plume, I personally called Scioto Township and participated in their meeting. Excuse me, and I'm not a resident. And they were, I guess I would say welcoming, at least, or at least certainly accepting of that. And actually, they didn't even ask where I was from. So I didn't offer it. So I just want to give that as a little bit of context. I also experienced quite a few years ago, a township resident, at least one, speaking in Ann Arbor in our open comment, and that was allowed in the first 10 speakers once by Mayor Hefje. I don't know what the precedents are or the rules, but I just wanted to just provide that as context, historic. Thanks.
Thanks, Rita. That's really important. We lose focus too often. Tom?
So I know you're talking about the rules and what you can and can't do. Something that could be done would be that the mayor and council members show some leadership and talk to their followers. A couple years ago, I wrote to the mayor and council essentially saying, there are a lot of attacks going on in individual people. People would get up and speak at public comment, public hearings, and be absolutely torn apart on social media. And some people were really hurt by that. And I've had people call me and email me and say, like, how do you do it, Tom? You speak a lot at public hearings and public comments, and they're tearing you apart on social media. And I say, because I don't take it personally, because I watched them do it for years before I was speaking, and I watch them do it to other people, and I don't take it personally because they're just going to do it. But how can we tamp that down? And that's when I wrote the mayor and council and saying, speak to your supporters, suggest that this isn't helpful, and we can keep applying that pressure. So you may not be able to control what goes on behind the scenes, but it really does set a tone, and that tone does cascade throughout our population, and it does impact what goes on in a council meeting. And I would like to see, you know, the mayor never got back to me. Some council members got back to me with polite responses, and one council member who's no longer on council got back to me with a pretty rude response. So I asked for leadership from all of you, and I think it would make a difference if the chirping in the background wasn't going on. It would help you all to have better, more civil meetings yourself. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. Jim, Juliet?
So what I'm about to say would require people to look at themselves perhaps with different eyes than they do. But I think that other than the rather excessive length of many city council members' comments, because for a long time, and I don't even know if it's true now, they didn't really observe the 3-minute rule as to themselves. I think the thing that I have taken most offense at over the last several years that I've been watching meetings is the degree, exactly what Tom said, the degree to which people take things personally and then spend a lot of time talking about how they're taking it personally and they're offended and they're really outraged. And, you know, that may all be true and might even be valid, but, you know, stop honking already because you're spending everybody's time forcing them to listen to you carry on. And I would say that of the now erstwhile council member who was best at sermonizing us, he kept pace with his counterpart, who is still on council, who still sermonizes every opportunity she gets. And it's obnoxious. You know, there's nothing about a person's personal viewpoint or religious beliefs or theologies or ideologies that gets any better by constantly taking up 3 or more minutes going over and over how much better they are than everybody else and how everybody should see it their way. Now, to boil that down, I'm borrowing from what Tom said, but you know, it's all because it has to be the personal viewpoint that we have to listen to instead of just trying to actually focus on the facts. People have the right to their opinion, of course. That's partly why we support you. We like your opinions, but just there, I don't even know how to translate it. It just needs to dumb itself down. That sense of outrage, that sense of entitlement that everybody has to listen to you, tell everybody else how you feel and what they should feel. It just gets old. And I think it really kind of raises people's danders anyway. So that's hope less than 3 minutes of honking myself.
Thank you. No, not at all. Valuable feedback, and one that we know is coming from, you know, your heart, and not just words. We gotta get moving, but I will say that I have asked that same thing that, and I'll call them rather than followers, our supporters. Asking our supporters to be more civil, asking our supporters to let us, you know, do the work that they're trying to do in ways that have come out and have been unproductive and toxic. And I asked the mayor too. I asked the mayor when we were in person the first 6 months, like, rein in some of this behavior, address it. And he just frankly, takes the side that he doesn't want to censor anybody. He thinks that it goes with the job. And it's a part of being an elected official. Unfortunately, we're not going to hear from the mayor unless he changes his point of view on those things. But we'll only try to hopefully improve myself. I know there's some improvement I can make.
I think the challenge is that this has been adopted as sort of part of the recipe for political success. And yeah. That's a shame.
Well,
for me,
under Trump for 4 years has given everybody the blank check to say whatever you want to say, you know, because that's how you get to the top. Perhaps, and that's how you win.
It's challenging. My biggest beef, to be perfectly honest, because I don't like to describe myself as being attacked. To me, like, it's just, that's just a lot of, like, just not helpful. Like Juliet said, like, it's a waste of everyone's time. But what I do find challenging is when the attacks and when the negativity and like just sort of the need to be angry or the feeling like there's an advantage to making people angry drives our discussion far, far away from facts. I really try very hard when I get an email from somebody just today who was actually supportive of a position that I hold, but was characterizing it in a way that wasn't quite right. DC1, anybody who has concerns about DC1, tomorrow night is not going to immediately grandfather people in. So if you feel strongly about that not happening, I'm happy to clarify for you, like, you don't need to send an angry email to council saying, like, whatever you do, don't pass tomorrow. Don't give this monopoly to these people. That's not quite what is happening tomorrow night. And I really want people to understand the facts of what is happening. Cause quite often we get these emails that the sky is falling and you're ruining everything. I just get really tired of having to write emails saying, you know, someone has persuaded you that something is happening that is not actually happening. Like, this is the truth of what is happening. I don't need people to support me because they've been persuaded that the sky is falling and something is happening that is not actually happening. I don't see that as a win. But I think that's not necessarily true for other people. I think there's an advantage that people are perceiving and are happy to collect. And I don't understand it. I just don't think it helps our politics locally. This is where our discussions should be really, really close to the ground and close to the facts that are really happening. We should not, there's no reason for us to stray into hyperbole and exaggeration and a lot of the other things that I so frequently see.
Well, we could spend quite a bit of time on this, and we have, unfortunately. I will say that it is purposely done as a diversion. It is purposely done to get you off your game, to get you not talking about the facts, and to start talking about everything else, and to have you pretty much be ineffective. So we'll move forward with a couple items. We have one, DC3, being brought to us by Councilmember Sung. It's the resolution to endorse House Bill 241, the Water Shutoff Protection Act. Councilmember Griswold.
Yes, it's actually Senate Bill 241 that was passed by the House, and the Senate took action after 5 p.m. on Friday to the bill was referred to the Secretary for Enrollment, Printing, and Presentation to the Governor. So I think what that means is it was sent over to the Governor to be signed, and I'm sure the Governor will sign it. So I will contact Lynn tomorrow morning and suggest that she make a couple of edits to this resolution or plan to amend it on the floor.
Yeah, I mean, that's the second whereas clause, while Ann Arbor has not experienced an increase in water shutoffs, we have agenda question response that says the contrary. You know, Ann Arbor has been experiencing an increase in water shutoffs. So as much as I support this, and it's in the House and Senate bill, but the body of this resolution has, just quickly looking at it, I do think we have problems that we just don't think we do.
Right. And the resolution would be to encourage the Governor to sign it. But in fact, the Governor may have signed it by the time we meet tomorrow.
OK.
That was a point I was making.
Thanks, Kathy.
You're welcome.
Anybody else? DC3? That leaves us just with one more, I think, DC4. Resolution to appoint 3 at-large members to the Council of the Commons and confirm the PAC appointment to the Council of the Commons, brought to us by Councilmember Hainer. We see that we have a representative from PAC, but in this, I do not see the 3 names from the city community at large. Does anybody have any information on that? Kathy.
I spoke to Jeff yesterday, and he was leaning towards moving to, I'm trying to think what the right word is. It's getting late, even though we started at 6. He would like to talk to all of the people who applied, and that may not be done before the first meeting in January. So he will probably move to postpone it until the first meeting in January.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, there's been quite a few people, I think 11 or 12 people from the community applied. When I got a static last, there wasn't that many. I need to go back and look. I'm obviously not one of the council members appointed with that responsibility, but very well, much interested in what happens. That being said, I think that brings us to just our public comment time and time for members of the body of the community to share any thoughts before we adjourn. Council members, anything? Leave it to, all right, we got Jim and Juliet.
We're chatty Cathy's tonight, at least I've been.
What happens in a pandemic, you know?
That's right. Actually, this is Jim's topic, so I should let him talk about it. But it has to do, we mentioned it earlier in Elizabeth's Coffee Hour, but it has to do with the number of streetlights that are out along Huron and Washtenaw. So I'm going to hand it over to the guy who actually counted them.
Yeah, and I immediately thought of Kathy Griswold.
I know. I'm going to get in trouble for my gesturing again, but I couldn't contain myself.
I can see you putting on your cape and reviewing these, but, you know, so we're going down, we were, you know, coming from the north end of town, going down west. Plymouth Road first. There we saw a lot of lights out, and, of course, the favorite garb of the people, the pedestrians, is all black, with the occasional white tennis shoe. So it's kind of spooky. And of course, you're getting that time of the year where you've got, you know, uncertain light. There's some snow places, there's not, but there were a lot of lights out, and I don't know why. Then we were at our son's house over on the west side of Ann Arbor, and going down Huron, there were.
We came back from Huron and Washtenaw.
Yeah, so there, as you got down toward campus area, there were a lot of lights out, particularly on what would have been the south side.
Huron, Forest, Washtenaw.
Yeah, and then, you know, we went up around by the university and then up, you know, Washtenaw, and more lights out. And I was amazed at how many lights were not lit. Now, I really thought, well, okay, is this a conservation measure?
Sure.
Are we trying to further dark skies for some reason?
I like what you think, Jim.
But
we pay by street light, whether it's lit or not. So we don't actually pay for the power. And I did send a letter to our city administrator last week about street light outages. And I know this time last year, DTE committed to doing a drive around and identifying lights. And I have been tracking 12 lights that are out on State Street near the I-94, which is a very dangerous area. And I noticed the same thing a couple of days ago. That's why I was so excited. I would recommend that you send an email to Tom Crawford, just a short one, because I'm usually the only person that talks about streetlights, as you know, and I could use some reinforcement.
I will vouch for Kathy. She did send Tom an email that do we need to bring a resolution to council? Like, what's the deal there? Like,
we'll be glad to weigh in on
that. I think we should assign a council person, possibly Kathy, to do a ride along.
You need somebody with a clipboard as you go along.
I know it's difficult. Sometimes I just take photos of locations in the dark.
But there were a lot. We thought there might be 25% of some of that area.
I was driving, and he was saying another one. And I just at that rate. It was weird.
Yeah. I would think crime would be another concern, right? Because you're in the campus areas, and you don't have enough light. I think that would be an addition to the pedestrian safety. I would be kind of concerned about crime.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sooner or later, it could be an issue. So anyway, that's all I got.
Thanks for listening to us.
Please follow up.
Mm-hmm. Tom, you got something for us?
Yeah, I got a really contentious issue. I want to thank you all. Wish you all happy holidays.
thanks. And the same to you all. I appreciate it. I don't know if that's going to be the last word. I don't know if anyone else has anything to say.
Thank you all. You're doing great work.
Keep wearing your masks, everybody.
Thanks for everybody sending these. They're obviously continuing, even with our new body. They'll continue as long as they get at least three of us or more. Hopefully, you can get a few more of our colleagues to join us. And tonight was a really rich meeting and a good way to end this very difficult year. I do think we did get a lot done this year in the midst of it all. I don't know if this council gets enough credit, or city staff for that matter, of continue to work through all the problems of COVID. You know, it's been ongoing for 9 or 10 months, and it's not business. And I think we've lost sight of that because it's been going on for so long. So appreciate it. Happy holidays, everyone, and stay in touch.
May I just say one thing? We've had problems with people trying to sign into Zoom, and what I discovered is that Zoom will change the meeting ID. For example, I sent this invitation for posting 10 days ago, and the ID that was on the invite 10 days ago is not the same ID number that went out 2 days ago when I sent the reminder. And that's probably what's happening with council meetings as well. And so I will look into it. So Zoom probably assumes most people go to Zoom, look for their meeting, and get the ID, and they don't expect us to be using an email from 10 days ago.
Well, thanks for looking into that, Kathy. I know it's been a problem for many people trying to call into our regular council meetings.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Take care, everyone. So good to see everybody.
Good night.
Good night.